You're listening to The Stressless Life with Dr. Yip, the podcast about conquering your fears and overcoming anxiety. Our question for the day is, body dysmorphic disorder, when does beauty become a burden? Let's say hello to Dr. Yip.
Hello, Noah.
Dr. Yip is a licensed psychologist who's board certified in behavioral cognitive therapy and an expert in the treatment of anxiety and OCD. Today, we are again recording from Washington, D.C. We're attending the ADAA annual conference, and we are very, very fortunate to have as our guest, Dr. Catherine Phillips. Hello, Dr. Phillips.
Hello.
Catherine Phillips, MD, is internationally known for her expertise in body dysmorphic disorder and related disorders. She's on the faculty at Weill Cornell Medical College and is a psychiatrist at New York Presbyterian Hospital, both in New York City. She is also professor of psychiatry and human behavior at the Alpert Medical School of Brown University. So, Dr. Phillips, you are one of the leading, if not leading, authorities on body dysmorphic disorder, so we're very lucky to have you here today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So, can you tell our audience who may not be familiar with what is BDD?
So, body dysmorphic disorder, known as BDD, is a common yet very under-recognized and often severe body image problem. So people with BDD think there's something very wrong with how they look. They look ugly, deformed. Some use very extreme terms. I look like a monster. Others use less extreme terms. There's something wrong with how I look. When in reality, they look really normal. And they not only have distorted perception of how they look, but they obsess about these perceived flaws or defects in their appearance, and it causes significant emotional distress in their day-to-day life or interferes with day-to-day functioning, usually both. So those are the things that differentiate body dysmorphic disorder from more normal appearance concerns. It's the obsession, the distress that these concerns cause, and the interference with day-to-day functioning.
We're all in agreement that looks do matter. Right? People that are good looking, they do appear to have it a little easier in some ways, right? And the distribution of good looks and beauty is inherently unfair, isn't it?
Beauty cuts both ways. So it can be advantageous in some circumstances and, you know, perhaps when initially meeting somebody, but it also has potential downsides. And beauty is only skin deep, as the saying goes. And especially as you get to know someone, as you work in a job and your ability to do the job and productivity really matters, beauty doesn't necessarily matter that much. And in sometimes it's a negative in terms of eliciting competitive responses from others, for example. So beauty is a mixed bag. And I think what's important, though, to emphasize is that most people with body dysmorphic disorder are not trying to look unusually beautiful. They think there's really something defective about their appearance, and they just want to look normal. They just want to blend into the crowd. Occasionally, some people really do have unrealistic beauty ideals for themselves. They want to be the best looking in their class, for example, but that's unusual. So usually it's they appear deviant. You know, they may say, I'm the ugliest person in the mall. I'm the ugliest person in my town, which is not true. Again, they look normal. They're often quite attractive people, and they really just want to look normal. And BDD is not vanity. It's a bona fide mental health condition that needs treatment.
So what are some of the things, you know, in terms of rituals or compulsions that people with BDD will do in order to sort of check and make sure that they're good enough?
Yeah. First, let me just mention, since I haven't, that people with BDD can focus on any part of the body and worry about perceived defects of the face or head are most common. So sometimes it gets confused with an eating disorder, and people with BDD sometimes do focus on their weight, but most often it's their skin, often facial skin. They're worried about discoloration or perceived acne or terrible scarring. And again, their skin typically looks normal, or if there is a flaw there, it's really quite minor and nothing that you would notice when you meet with them, and yet they think it's really obvious to everybody. Hair concerns are second most common. It can be anything about the hair. Worries about going bald, hair's too curly, uneven, too straight. Nose concerns are the third most common, usually that the nose is too large or misshapen, but it can be any part of the body, jaw, lips, teeth, breasts, legs, sometimes weight. And then in response to these preoccupations, people do perform repetitive behaviors that are hard to resist or control. And we refer to them variably as compulsions or rituals or repetitive behaviors, a lot like excessive hand washing and OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. But these are things like excessive mirror checking, excessive grooming, makeup application, hairstyling. People may spend hours a day in front of the mirror trying to fix these perceived flaws in their appearance, and they usually are not happy with the outcome. Reassurance seeking, asking other people, do I look okay? Can you see this on my face? And typically, no matter what the response, and of course, they do look okay, but no matter what the response, people with this condition tend not to accept that positive response that they look okay. Sometimes compulsive skin picking, comparing with others. There's just a whole range of compulsive behaviors that people with BDD can perform. And typically these compulsive behaviors don't help them feel any better. They'll say they still see what they see in the mirror. It tends not to alleviate anxiety or distress.
It would be fair to say, though, that all of us participate in these a little bit. We all maybe check the mirror for a long time when we go out, right? But so how long would someone with BDD spend checking in the mirror?
It's variable. I think when we add up all these repetitive behaviors together and ask people how much time they're spending, typically it's between 3 and 8 hours a day that they're doing these repetitive behaviors and obsessing about how they look, usually at the same time. So that's substantially more than most people will spend. And yes, you know, looking in the mirror is typical normative behavior among people without BDD, and some grooming is normal and hairstyling, but people with BDD feel very driven to do it and to do it excessively. And they're not satisfied with the outcome typically. And then some of these behaviors are not typical of what most people do. So most people do not pick their skin, for example. So some are behaviors that are more specific to BDD.
Earlier, you were just talking about social comparisons and a lot of people who suffer from BDD, and a lot of people have a lot of social comparison behaviors. Mm-hmm. Earlier, we were just talking with Dr. Stefan Hoffman about social anxiety, and where with people with social anxiety, there are also a lot of social comparisons. Mm-hmm. Is there a correlation between BDD and social anxiety?
Absolutely. It's a great question. Usually, you know, most of the research in our field has focused on the overlap with obsessive compulsive disorder, because BDD, like OCD, is characterized by repetitive, obsessional preoccupation, these unwanted, unpleasant thoughts that are difficult to control, and the repetitive compulsive behaviors, also time-consuming, difficult to control. But there's a lot of overlap between BDD and social anxiety disorder. Both conditions, as you say, are characterized by these sort of comparisons, social comparisons. Do I measure up? Am I good enough? There's a lot of fear and anxiety in both conditions about, am I being negatively judged? Am I as good as others? They're both characterized by rejection sensitivity, high levels of that on average. So fears that you won't be accepted because of how you look in BDD or because of what you might say, for example, in social anxiety disorder. And people with body dysmorphic disorder tend to have a lot of social anxiety and avoidance. And it makes sense because they think they look really abnormal and they think people are noticing this. And even most of them think that other people are noticing them more than they notice other people in general, so that other people are taking special notice of them in a negative way. They worry, for example, if they walk into a restaurant, people are being distracted from their meals because they look so ugly. Now, not everyone with BDD thinks that, but it's common. So it makes sense that if you're experiencing this, you're going to be very anxious in social situations and very avoidant in social situations. So we do see a lot of overlap between those two conditions. Sometimes, in fact, not uncommonly in my experience, body dysmorphic disorder is misdiagnosed as social anxiety disorder because patients typically find it easier to talk about their social anxiety and avoidance, and more difficult to say, I think my eyes look really awful. They're uneven. I think my nostrils look disgusting and everyone's noticing this. I think it's harder for many patients to talk about the appearance concerns. They worry they'll be considered vain. They think that now you'll notice even more what the problem is. And so if you think someone has social anxiety disorder, you want to ask what's making them anxious. And if it's appearance concerns about how they look, they may actually have BDD instead. And treatment's a little bit different for both conditions. So it's important to distinguish them. They often co-occur occur, though, I should mention. So many people with BDD also have social anxiety disorder. So social anxiety for other reasons other than how they look.
So a person can be diagnosed with both social anxiety and BDD.
It's common. About 40% of people with BDD also have co-occurring social anxiety
disorder. That's a pretty high prevalence rate. So for people with BDD and they have these distorted perceptions about their appearance and how people judge them, what lengths do they go to fix that flawed part of their body?
Most try, and some go to extreme lengths. People try to fix what they don't like by camouflaging and trying to hide what they don't like. It's not a permanent fix typically, but with makeup, or, you know, they may try and hide their, what they think is their gigantic nose by growing their hair long and covering their nose, and actually maybe even have a trouble seeing where they're going. About 2/3 of people with body dysmorphic disorder get cosmetic treatment for their perceived flaws. Rhinoplasty, nose job, is the most common surgery, and dermatologic treatment and surgery are the most commonly sought cosmetic procedures, which makes sense. Skin, hair, nose, these are the most common concerns. So the problem with cosmetic surgery and dermatologic treatment is it seems not to help these concerns, the BDD symptoms, and in some cases can actually make it worse. And I've seen many, many patients who so regret the fact that they have had cosmetic treatment. In my clinical experience, the regret is greatest for surgery because that tends to be a more dramatic kind of treatment and perhaps more permanent effects. And they and their lives can be just devastated and destroyed by what they perceive as poor outcome with cosmetic surgery. You know, a patient I saw recently, for example, is a young aspiring actor, very good looking young man. He did have BDD and he decided he was going to get a nose job rhinoplasty. And subsequently, he thought that the rhinoplasty, although objectively the outcome was fine, he never needed it in the first place, the outcome was fine. And he made several very serious suicide attempts within the following month, ended up being psychiatrically hospitalized multiple times, and to self-medicate his anxiety and distress over what he thought was a terrible outcome with the rhinoplasty, developed a very severe substance abuse problem. We do not recommend cosmetic treatment for BDD. I think it makes sense that it wouldn't work because the problem isn't with how people look. It's with distorted body image and a tendency to obsess and get distressed over these defects that are actually only non-existent or only slight. And so changing a surface characteristic through surgery or dermatologic treatment seems not to help. And in about maybe a third to half of cases, people say, well, you know, that procedure was okay. And maybe they're actually, that body area looks a little bit better, but then they switch to something else and start obsessing about another body area. Some people even do their own surgery. If you want extreme, more desperate attempts, some people actually try to do their own facelift, like with a staple gun. Or one patient I saw cut open his nose with a razor blade and tried to replace his nose cartilage with chicken cartilage in the shape that he preferred. I know of someone who took a scalpel and cut open his forehead and tried to do his own forehead surgery. So I think this points to how distressing BDD can be and how desperate some people can be to try to change how they look.
All sounds a little scary. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that some people will go to correcting their flaws or correcting their perceived flaws. Now, with that risky behavior, would you say that there's a higher risk for suicidality or other types of risky behaviors in people diagnosed with BDD?
Yes, and I'm glad you mentioned that because suicidality is very common in people with BDD. Our studies indicate that at least about 80% have thoughts that life isn't worth living or thoughts of suicide at some point during their life. About a quarter actually attempt suicide, some many, you know, multiple times. And we don't have a lot of research data on completed actual suicide. The bit of data that we have, which I collected in one of my studies, suggests a very high rate of completed suicide, and perhaps higher than for any other psychiatric disorder. So these people, this condition, you know, BDD can sound trivial, right? Don't we all worry about our appearance? But the reality is, this is among the more severe of all psychiatric conditions, and high rates of co-occurring depression and substance abuse, and often self-medication of the distress. And suicide does occur in these patients, and you have to be alert to that. Family members need to be aware and alert. Clinicians need to be. This is a very treatable condition with the right treatment. Very treatable. But suicide is definitely a concern in people with BDD, and we think the rates are very high.
So let's talk a little bit about treatment. Mm-hmm. How has BDD treatment evolved over the years, and what is the current state of things?
It's evolved enormously. So when I started my clinical and research work on BDD back in the early 1990s, BDD was not known. It wasn't on the map. Clinicians weren't aware of it. Sufferers weren't aware of it. Family members weren't aware. It had been described since the 1800s, but had been just fallen through the cracks. It just wasn't on anyone's radar screen. We had no treatments. So I have really devoted my career to trying to understand BDD and develop treatments for it, and others have joined in that effort. And so the good news is we now have really good treatments, not a lot of treatment studies compared to other common conditions, but the studies that have been done are very consistent in showing that two types of treatment work for a majority of people. So one is certain medications known as serotonin reuptake inhibitors, also known as SRIs or SSRIs, and the other is cognitive behavioral therapy, a widely used therapy in our field, but it does need to be tailored to BDD's unique symptoms. So happy to tell you more about either both of those.
Well, let's talk about the medication part first. Sure. And Dr. Yip can handle the CBT. So what are the two or three medications that you usually end up being on, and what do you recommend for people?
So we recommend a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, which is classified as an antidepressant, although it treats a lot of a whole broad spectrum of symptoms, not just depression. And we recommend that rather than other antidepressants because they counteract obsessional preoccupation and compulsive behaviors. So the SRIs have that specific effect, as well as treating depression, anxiety, social anxiety, suicidal thinking. And there are 7 SRIs available in the United States. The best studied have been Prozac. The generic name is fluoxetine, and Lexapro, generic name is escitalopram, but the others also work. They haven't been as well studied, but we know from clinical experience and studies of other disorders that if one SRI works, the others are likely to work. So that would also include Zoloft. Sertraline is the generic name. Luvox, fluvoxamine is the generic name. There are a few others I don't use as often because the ones I've already mentioned tend to be better tolerated. But these medications help a majority of people if taken every day. But I think there's a caveat to be aware of. We often need pretty high doses of these medications. And in my experience, most people get doses that are too low. You need doses that are more like those often needed for obsessive compulsive disorder. If you just use doses that are typically used for depression or anxiety, you may not be getting enough of the medication. So sometimes we exceed the maximum recommended dose of these medications, which is fine. For 5 out of the 7, it's fine to do that if you need to and if you're tolerating it well. And you also need generally at least a 12 to 16 week trial to see if the medication's going to work for you while getting up to a high dose. Some people get better with lower doses, but on average, the doses are on the high end of the spectrum. But the good news is most people tolerate these doses really well. If you get side effects, which some people do, you can often work your way around them and make them tolerable for the person. So these medications are often incredibly helpful. We find that anywhere from about 2/3 to 3/4 of people will improve substantially with the trial of these medicines. And if you really stick with it every day and complete the 12 to 16 week trial, somewhere like 75% to 80% of people substantially improve. And if one doesn't work, you can try another. They're also medications you can add in to boost the effect of these medications if you need to. They can really, life-saving is not too strong a word to use, especially when patients are very, you know, when they're high risk for suicide, for example, I always recommend one of these medications. They really can have a dramatic effect.
If the medications are so effective, where does CBT come in or why? Because I know many patients would actually, it'll be challenging for them to even engage in CBT, right?
Right. Well, I think the good news here is we have 2 kinds of treatment that usually help BDD. So people have a choice. And they've not been compared head to head in a trial, so we don't know which is better and for whom, but they appear to both be effective for a majority of people. So I think CBT is a terrific option, and especially if that's what the person prefers. So CBT is, you know, it's a more general treatment approach used for a whole wide range of psychiatric and non-psychiatric conditions, like insomnia, for example. We do tailor it to BDD's unique symptoms, and it's very skills-based. You learn specific skills. I always tell patients it's a little bit like taking a class in some ways, and people learn to become more aware of their negative thoughts about their appearance, to develop more accurate and helpful thoughts and beliefs about their appearance. We help them get better control over those excessive, repetitive, ritualistic behaviors that they're doing, help them start spending less time in the mirror, less time comparing with others. Those are toxic behaviors that just fuel the negative thoughts. We help them feel more comfortable going out and being around people. It's easy. We teach them strategies to make that easier through doing exposures and having them collect evidence during the exposure for whether the things they fear will happen while they're out there, like people will laugh at them because of how they look. We have them collect evidence for that. We do some mirror again for and against that. And of course, the evidence is that if they really collect the evidence is that these things aren't happening. We do some mirror retraining. It's not staring in the mirror, but we help them develop a more holistic and accurate view of their appearance. We do some work with self-esteem as well, which tends to be very low in BDD. So we use a whole variety of techniques.
How do you motivate patients with BDD to do exposures when they're so often depressed?
Yes.
And exposures can also bring upon certain shame feelings.
Right.
They can end up feeling just really terrible about themselves or even worse than when they started. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that?
We often have to do some motivational work in people with BDD more generally because insight tends to be very poor in BDD. Compared to obsessive compulsive disorder, for example. So the majority of people with BDD think they really do look ugly, or they probably look ugly, probably because they seem to actually be seeing something different in the mirror than we see. Like people with anorexia, they seem to have some actual visual perceptual distortions. So their insight tends to be poor, and then that makes them want the cosmetic treatment rather than our treatment, the meds or the CBT. So we often have to do some motivational work to get them into treatment and during the treatment. We do a couple of things to make the exposures a little bit easier and more doable. One is we, in addition to the motivational work, we do cognitive work first to help them begin to understand that maybe their thinking isn't quite accurate. To help them identify errors in their thinking, like assuming they know what other people are thinking, mind reading. And so we think that helps with the exposures. They've already made some progress in the treatment. And then with the exposures, we're careful to make them doable. We don't push them as quickly or make them as you might in OCD, for example. So we kind of take them a step at a time. We work very collaboratively with the patient to make sure they're really on board with trying it, make sure it's not too difficult. Got to be a little challenging, but not too hard. They do the exposure kind of armed with their cognitive restructuring. And we also have them collect evidence during the exposure, evidence for and against their prediction about what's going to happen. You know, for example, that people will be laughing at them. And then that makes it, I think, more effective and probably makes it, I think, doable for them. People generally report that the exposures are really helpful. And if they come back and say that was too hard and they were too anxious, then we figure out how to make it a little bit more doable for them. The idea is to make it doable for the person. It's challenging, but doable.
So earlier you said that mirror retraining is part of the treatment. Can you explain what that means?
Sure. Because people with BDD appear to overfocus on tiny detail and have difficulty seeing the big picture of what they are looking at. And we know this from quite sophisticated studies using functional MRI and EEG. We believe, like people with anorexia, they actually see something different than others do, and they have excessive focus on detail. We have them stand in front of mirrors. We use mirror hierarchy, easier mirrors, harder mirrors, and we rank order them, and lighting can make a difference, and distance from the mirror can make a difference. So we have them develop a so-called mirror hierarchy, and in terms of easier to harder mirrors, we have them start out with the easier ones, and we model this for them first, but we do an exercise. It's about 5 minutes a day, or you can do it twice a day, in which we have them describe their appearance from head to toe without overly focusing on the body parts that they dislike, because that's their tendency. We know that from eye tracking studies, actually. They zero in on the things they hate, and they're all kinds of negative self-talk. Oh, look at that pig nose. Oh, your lips look all bizarre and crooked and chapped and puffy, and these are the very negative self-talk. So we have them start, just describe themselves in 5 minutes from head to toe without overly focusing on the disliked areas. We're helping them see the rest of themselves and describe themselves out loud in a non-judgmental way. So rather than saying, oh, I have a big disgusting pig nose, it's all bulbous and bumpy, we say, you know, my nose is about 2 inches long and it's maybe a half, 2/3 of an inch wide. And we use a lot of measurements, and you can't do any rituals during this. Can't start fixing your hair, for example, that, you know, minimizes the effectiveness of the exercise. And we use some mindfulness techniques during this exercise. If the really negative self-talk enters in your mind, you just notice it and let it, see if you can disengage, let it float away and refocus on the exercise at hand. It's just important to emphasize we do not have patients do extended staring in the mirror, because if anything, we theorize that this makes them even more sensitive to tiny little imperfections that other people generally don't see, and may even reinforce that tendency to overfocus on detail. And in fact, if anything, with our ritual prevention, we want them to spend less time looking in mirrors.
You said that there are difficult mirrors and easier mirrors. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm thinking a mirror is a mirror is a mirror.
Well, I think even people without BDD might say they look better in some mirrors than others. Lighting can make a difference. You know, the worst mirrors, of course, are those magnifying mirrors. You know, most people aren't happy when they look in those because it magnifies every little thing, every little pore, every little line, everything. So people with BDD know mirrors really well because they usually spend so much time in them. So they may think one just gives them a more flattering or less negative view, and lighting and distance and those kinds of things can make a difference. So we have them start with easier mirrors. And once they feel comfortable with this mirror exercise, we have them start working on the more difficult mirrors. Again, it's only about 5 minutes a day. And then we also have them refrain from making extra checks of mirrors throughout their day. That's part of the ritual prevention.
Do you find that there is a difference in gender? Are there more? I mean, I'm just, you know, thinking women tend to care more about their appearance. So, you know, is there a gender difference?
Well, as my colleagues and I wrote about in a book called The Adonis Complex, published a while ago, body image concerns are very common in men. So maybe not quite as common as in women, but probably increasing. And I think very, very underrecognized. So studies definitely show that. Now, when it comes to BDD, which echoes normal appearance concerns, but of course is problematic body image concerns, we find, you know, it's about probably, studies vary in terms of the gender ratio. It's probably about 60% women, 40% men. Many people are surprised to hear that. They think it's more like, you know, anorexia or bulimia, but it definitely affects men. And men and women are generally similar across a whole range of BDD characteristics, but there are a few gender differences. So men are more likely to worry, for example, that they're going bald than women. Women are more likely to worry about excessive body hair. Men are more worried about, you know, genitals and genital size. Women are more likely to worry about their weight. And so some of these concerns echo normal, you know, what we might call more normal, normative appearance concerns. Men are more likely to have a substance use disorder, and we haven't really talked about that. But substance use disorders are very common in people with BDD. We have some recent data for both alcohol and drug use showing that the most common reason people use alcohol and abuse alcohol and drugs is to self-medicate distress, not just to get high, not just for social reasons, although sometimes that's part of the picture for some people, but the most common reason is to cope with distress. And we find about half of people who use alcohol and drugs say they're specifically trying to cope with the distress caused by their body image concerns. So common problem.
If there's someone out there listening who may thinks they maybe have BDD or knows someone that does, what kind of words of wisdom would you have for them?
First, I think listen to their concerns. Try to understand what the person is going through and recognizing that they're probably suffering if they have these problematic body image concerns. It's best not to simply reassure them and say, you look fine. Or if you do and they don't accept that, maybe they have BDD. It's not helpful to say, oh, don't worry, you'll just get over it. It's not helpful to say, especially with adolescents, oh, this is just a phase, don't worry. It does usually begin during adolescence, actually. I think it's important to listen and take their concerns seriously and offer to support them. And if you think they might have body dysmorphic disorder, you can say that. You know, I've heard about this condition called body dysmorphic disorder. It's a common body image condition. I wonder if you might have it. You can read about it. I've published books on BDD, Understanding Body Dysmorphic Disorder and The Broken Mirror, and there are lots of information out there. And then if you think they might have it, I encourage have them see a mental health professional who's familiar with this condition, because as I said, we have very good treatments, both medication and cognitive behavioral therapy for BDD. So a majority of people can get better. So the main thing is to recognize it if it's there and seek effective treatment.
One last question. We are from Los Angeles, mm-hmm. the plastic city.
Mm-hmm.
In your research, have you discovered that demographically there are more people suffering from BDD in certain regions of the world that focus more on beauty and appearance?
It's a really good question. We don't have studies that would answer that. So we know that in the general population, studies done in the US and Europe, BDD affects about 2-3% of the population. So that's more common than OCD or anorexia, for example. But we don't know if it's more common some places than others. We do know that it probably occurs everywhere. And it's been reported actually in places where that have no access to television, to computers, to advertising. BDD, it probably has an evolutionary basis in part, in addition to probably also being influenced by cultural beauty ideals pertaining to beauty and all these pressures that we all experience coming from the media and social media in particular. But BDD is probably, universal and probably occurs everywhere. Perhaps it's more common in certain places like LA. We don't know that for a fact, but it may be.
Is there a treatment manual available for this condition?
Yes, there are actually two, and I recommend them because the therapists use them, because I think it can be challenging to treat body dysmorphic disorder without a treatment manual. And it's easy to go wrong with the treatment because it does differ from the treatment for obsessive compulsive disorder, for example. So one is, the first author is Dr. Sabina Wilhelm, and then I and Dr. Gail Steckety co-authored this treatment manual. It's Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Body Dysmorphic Disorder, published by Guilford Publications. And then there is another Cognitive Behavioral Therapy treatment manual for body dysmorphic disorder. This one was authored and developed by David Veal and Fugan Nazaroglu. And that treatment manual is also available on Amazon.
Dr. Phelps, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That's all the time we have today. You've been listening to the Stressless Life podcast. Send questions, comments, or episode ideas to thestresslesslife@dryip.com. Check out our website at www.dryip.com/podcast. If you like what you've been hearing, please write us a review on iTunes. We'd really appreciate it. Until next time, stay stressless.